Welcome back to Tasteland. I'm your co-host, Francis Zierer.
And I'm Daisy Alioto.
And who are we talking to today, Daisy?
Today, we're talking to Nika Simovich-Fisher. She's a writer, design strategist, and educator based in New York. She's currently a tenure-track assistant professor of communication design at Parsons School of Design. And she also is a journalist and a writer. She's written for Dirt. And we worked on something really cool together that's going to be coming out next week. So we're excited to tell you about it.
I have no idea what it is, similar to the listener. So I'm excited to hear about it.
The ideal proxy audience.
While we wait for her to get here, I did just get back from Berlin. My annual trip to Berlin last night. JFK was terrible. The worst airport in the tri-state area. I don't know if it's the worst in the tri-state. Definitely the worst in the city. But I had a great time.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I do not envy you. Was it hot in there?
It was hot. It was hot. And we had to wait to get off because the police had to come on first before anyone could get off. I think a guy was not following the rules. By the looks of him, I think he was vaping.
But I mean, handle that in the tunnel, dude. Like,
I know. I mean, it's like a 7-hour
flight.
Where
is he going to go?
If
the police have to talk to him, talk to him in the tunnel. Just like, yeah. Where is he going to go?
But they had to come on first to pull him up. But the other thing, I don't understand why he doesn't just zin.
Yeah, that's crazy. I don't know.
Anyways, it was hellish. But I had a good time in Berlin. For our fragrance heads out there, we can have a little mini fragrance segment. I did go to my favorite perfume store in Berlin.
Breathe. This is where you got the tomato note perfume last year.
Yes, and we smelled like everything they had, and I ended up getting something from the same brand, Min, okay. New York.
This is the place where they spray onto glass, and you smell the glass.
Onto glass, yes. Yeah. Did you see my Instagram story? Maybe you did, maybe you didn't.
Weirdly, no. But yeah, I don't watch a lot of Instagram stories.
Oh, that's okay. Well, it's
not
like
in a haha way. I think I just like, I don't know.
Anyways, it's like these glass rods that they, I think there's like, he probably sprays it into, like, they go into these metal canisters. He probably sprays it in there, and there's, like, some kind of, like, absorbent thing at the end of it that leaves the smell in it. Anyways, I got Dune Road, which is
sounds epic.
It's epic. It's a marine scent. I'll read you the copy from their website very quickly.
Hit me with the notes.
Summer walks. Crisp ocean breeze, foamy sand, whispers of herbs, wildflowers, and seagrass from a distance. Top, absinthe, cardamom, and ozone. Heart, marine, salt, seagrass, seaweed, and driftwood. Base, now I don't know how to pronounce this word, vetiver? Vetiver?
Oh, vetiver, yeah.
Vetiver, mm-hmm. Okay. Cedarwood and musk. When you first spray it on, it's really like a cucumber or like a melon. Mm. Mm-hmm. Mm, it's really nice.
That sounds great. When you said Dune, I was thinking the franchise, but this is way more up my alley. I will say, I've been sort of sensitive to ozone scents recently. Huh. But hopefully,
I don't even really know what that means.
Ozone is like what you smell on concrete after it rains.
Oh, it's I do like that.
Yeah.
There was one scent called Tears on Asphalt. It was really bitter. I didn't really like it.
I think the problem is that, like, to get an ozone scent, it's very synthetic. And I think the more synthetic a scent is, the more likely, for me at least, that I'm, like, sensitive to
it.
Yeah.
But you like no sulfites in your natural scents. I don't know.
Well, I am driving back up to Maine today. Speaking of
marine scents.
My friend Caroline from college, she lives in Chicago, and she messaged me a few months ago and was like, hey, I have a conference at Bowdoin. I'm flying into New York. I would love to see you in New York. And I was like, well, I'll do you one better. I will drive you up.
Oh, there you go.
So I'm picking her up in New Paltz and then driving her. She's going to stay with me tonight, and then I'm going to bring her to campus for her conference.
What's her name? Wait, was it Caroline or Catherine?
Caroline with a K.
Caroline from college sounds like some like indie band, like Bandcamp album from like 2011.
I know. And like, we've both like, I haven't seen her in a while. We've both like had a ton of changes in our lives. She got married. Like, she's also not in our group chat because she has an Android. And so like, Caroline's always like, what Caroline's doing is like always like sort of a mystery.
It's kind of chic.
It's very chic. And like, I get to have like the full car download. So I'm really looking forward to it.
Mm-hmm. A lot. You get to have a live podcast.
It's also going to be like less hot in Harpswell. So I'm really excited about that. It's
fucking brutal rolling into New York. Anyways, Nika.
Did you vote for mayor?
I did vote for mayor early. Actually, yeah, I voted like a week ago, right before I left. I went to do early voting, but I had to do an affidavit because I had requested a mail-in ballot like 2+ weeks before. Mm-hmm. It never came. And I checked just today. Today is Tuesday, the final day of voting. And it still never came. So anyways, let's let Nika in and chat with her.
I can't vote in New York, to be clear. I live in Westchester, so...
My old
classmate, Zoran Mamdani, is maybe going to win it all. So I do feel very invested in the outcome.
Seem like no matter what happens, it seems like him and Cuomo are both going to run anyways, just on whatever other lines.
Yes, but I do think the outcome of today will determine how strong of a position that is.
Yeah. Yeah.
It'll be interesting to see too, just because their campaigns are so different. Like Andrew Cuomo just doesn't really have one in a lot of ways. Like he's running on his name and his familiarity. And I think Zoran's really killing it with media and just having, you know, even like walking across New York City. That was insane, right? So he's much more visible and trying. So I think it's like very opposite approaches.
Mm-hmm. Curious to see I checked my mail today after being gone for a week, and there was a couple like local Ridgewood campaign mailers, but then there was like five or six just anti Zoran ones with the thing like paid for by by the top three donors at
least Bloomberg,
DoorDash, and Bill Ackman.
I mean, it's interesting. I also, from a design perspective, the campaign's choices I think are very cool and. Mm. Sean Monahan, who we should have on the pod at some point, writes a newsletter called 8Ball. He wrote one about yellow fonts and yellow fonts being everywhere. And this was an example and sort of like, okay, is this like the new Brat Green, this yellow gold font? I guess it's almost like marigold colored that has already become so recognizable. And also like using...
It's kind of Mets coded too.
Yeah. And the design conventions of like WhatsApp stickers, playing around with those... I've thought that's really interesting. And yesterday I saw in Frances, you know her better than me, but Rachel Carton in her newsletter was talking about the production studio that works with a lot of these progressive candidates on their videos, like the one like the one of walking down the city. Overnight.
Yeah, it's called like Butter something. What are they called?
It's Anthony DiMieri one of the gentlemen who's involved with it. And I think he also does those like subway takes. Have you seen
those? He does. He works with Kareem. Works with Ari, Daisy. We met him at the Air Series B party. He was there.
Ari is our next guest. Mm-hmm. The Tasteland extended universe is curling back on itself.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know him, Nika?
Yeah, I've met Anthony once, but I read that interview too, and I thought it was interesting how he was saying how before people come in with like a script and he really encourages them not to use it and to improvise. I think there's something about that that plays out in design at large, like things sort of feeling natural versus forced or I don't know. Yeah. It's interesting thinking about her. Go ahead. But yeah.
Well, like the big thing that stood out to me too was one of the partners says like, it's better to have people around the candidate who are literate in memes and sort of micro trends rather than for the candidate to try to participate in them because that's cringe. And it's like, that's so true. And you can really see the difference in Zoran's campaign with that. At the same time, like you have like people like JD Vance becoming so millennial coded because he constantly tries to participate himself and people really rejecting that.
Melted Solids, by the way, real quick. That's the name of the group.
Butter is a melted solid, so I really can see where that came
where that came from.
Like, it's a really interesting
JD Vance this morning being like, "Do you think any VP has had to deal with like
that was
what
insane.
I deal with, like emoji lol cow?" And it's like, Well, yes, we do, because Dick Cheney was president.
Or so. the other thing. The
we
other
all day, saw Vice.
Where it was like, the difference this time is that our other presidents were dumb, and this one isn't.
That's, I'm still not convinced that's real, but.
I didn't watch the clip, to be honest.
What is real, I spent a really long time last night. So we, like, as you know, like, Nika, we have this new site, Clone. And we sort of messed up, like we put this Forbes article up that was like not well sourced. And it was like, Forbes used to be reliable. Hmm. Now they do a lot of SEO bait. And it was about a leaked password hack. And somebody emailed us and was like, hey, this doesn't seem legit. And I sort of at the time was like, I should check this. And then I got busy with something else. And so it was actually like it was a learning lesson. It was a good moment for us to be like, hey, guys, like we should like be better about this. To the extent that we have an editorial process, we shouldn't be aggregating stuff that's like bait. But when I saw last night that there was like this Norwegian article about a guy who got turned away at the border because they searched his phone and he had like a chubby JD Vance meme on there, I was like, I spent like a really long time trying to make sure it was legit because the actual Norwegian article was like paywalled. So I was like, is this the Norwegian equivalent of The Onion? And it took like kind of a long time for me to figure it out, but I was like, I'm not falling for this.
That's
again.
The value you get at Clone.
Yeah. I mean, I come out of traditional news. So if there's a failure in the process, like I blame myself because Boys Club they have like great backgrounds for what we're doing, but they don't come out of a traditional newsroom. And I was like, yes, it is. It does seem to be legit. If I find out today it's not, then I will apologize publicly. But yeah, I don't know where I was going with this other than to say, like, that's crazy.
Twitter's real life.
Well, I think it also has to do with like the design of things and how just everything is hard to discern sometimes. And I think maybe it's kind of how we were talking about believability with the campaigns. And I was thinking about Kamala's too. Like, she definitely picked up that brat, you know, motif from a pop star that was somebody else's design language. And so I'm wondering where it fits into this, like in terms of you were saying that JD Vance sort of is trying to speak to this audience, but kind of signing on, and Zoran has people doing it for him. So I don't know where that fits into the story.
Yeah. And it's not that it doesn't just age you generationally, but it also sort of ages you in the news cycle. And I think like good communication and design should be timeless. And even though like the internet moves at the speed of the internet, obviously like people are learning that actually there's something about participation in these micro trends that really degrades your message.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a stand-in for having the actual message. Like I'm reminded of some TikTok that I saw getting like retweeted a lot on Twitter last week. Of these two
a TikTok
girls.
On Twitter, whoever a TikTok on Twitter, thing.
But it was of these two girls, like doing the audio track was Zoran at the debate when he was saying like, because I am not you, Mr. Cuomo, and you know spelling out his name and stuff. And I just saw like a few different retweets making the point like when you have a message that people want to be associated with, you get all this free media. When you sort of become the meme, but not in like a derisive way or like a dilutive way, but like more of just actual good earned media, because it's cool and because people want to be associated. And then they were wearing the hats, the blue hats with the orange writing and such.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Nika, or false, you recently won one of a piece of jewelry from Otessa Moshfegh's auction.
I did.
Are you
What's
wearing
the
it right now?
This auction?
The auction was really cool. I'm not wearing it right now. I wore it on my birthday, which is the day after I obtained this piece of jewelry. And I think maybe I wore it once after that. But no, it was hosted by Substack and it was at Golden Unicorn. Have you been there? It's like a Chinese restaurant.
I have. Yeah. Wasn't Eddie Wong, he was part of this auction too?
Yeah. He was, yeah. It was, you know, I had never really thought that I'd want to go to an auction, but my friend invited me and it was the day before my birthday and I kind of like to not make any plans for my birthday. So I was like, this is perfect.
It was.
And they had like a real auctioneer, like from Christie's. He was very enthusiastic. And then they were like selling off all these different things. Like the jewelry was actually the most practical and like the least expensive thing. Mm-hmm. So I feel lucky about that win. But like they were selling like a used toothbrush that went for like $200.
Boy, that's like, so crazy. It's you can frame to that, Sydney Sweeney's bathwater.
Yeah, it's the same vibe. Or like Unlicensed Therapy with Eddie Wong went up for like, I think, 1,000 or something.
Well, that's worth it. Mm. Yeah, I think he could really fix my life.
Give you some hard truths.
Okay, speaking of hard truths, there's actually a good transition. I'm proud of this one. You have a new piece in a magazine called Hard Pack that I'd never actually heard of before. And you're tying like a lot of ideas from the zeitgeist together. Can you sort of explain this piece and the genesis of it?
Yeah, sure. So Hard Pack is a magazine about skiing, but it's not really about skiing. It's about ski and things that are adjacent to it.
Okay, so strong is not actually about tennis.
Yeah, you're right. And I don't know if you had, do you remember Wax magazine by any chance? It was like 10 years ago, but it was kind of a similar vibe where it was about surfing, but it was really about like art surfing and people in big cities that like to surf, but it's also very beautifully produced. But anyway, so Hard Pack is similar in that vein where it's like about one thing, but it's kind of about these like tangential interests. And I wrote a piece called Melting Legacies, and it's about the overlooked ties between a ski lodge, independent publishing, and the art of book design. But I don't know. So it was Zach Seeley, who's really incredible, and he's the editor. He invited me to write about this, and he was interested in Alvin Lustig, who was like this like famous mid-century like book designer. And he was interested in like the overlaps between like mid-century book design and skiing, because I learned this when I was doing this, but skiing is also sort of like a mid-century hobby. It was, you know, kind of used in wartime before, but not really. It's like a leisurely hobby.
It wasn't, I had no idea. It wasn't really much of a hobby. It was just like a way of getting around for troops.
Yeah, exactly. I don't like divert too much, but I heard like a crazy, this is like a family friend's family story about.
So it's hearsay.
It's hearsay. Yeah, this is like, I'm 2 degrees removed, but I always like kept it with me in case I end up in this exact situation. But somebody in the family was Norwegian. They're part of the resistance during World War II. They're getting chased on like, chased through the woods by a Nazi soldier. Both of them are on skis. What's it called when you're flat skiing?
Cross country
skiing through the woods, and he's like ahead, but he's like, I don't know how long I can stay ahead. So what he does is he gets ahead enough that he's out of this Nazi soldier's visibility, turns around, drops, waits for the Nazi to come, shoots,
scores.
Yeah, so it's like, I was like, oh yeah, like that's like, that is what you should do. Like if you're outrunning somebody and you don't know if you can outrun them, just like pull a reverse Yahtzee. Anyway,
reverse Yahtzee.
So but I could understand, here's the thing, I could understand why somebody in that scenario or friends with people in that scenario might not like after the war be like, you know, it would be so relaxing. You know, it would be so relaxing, you guys.
Okay, wait, but back
let's
to
go
the
mountains.
Back to the original. Where were we?
Oh, no, it's true. It's kind of interesting to think about the origins of things, and sometimes things are more recent than you had anticipated. But that's a cool family lore moment.
Somebody's going to write in and be like, Daisy, that's from a cheese retriever story. And I'm like, shut up. It was told to me. What's the connection to the publishing through one particular lodge?
Yeah. So it's through Atlas Alta Ski Resort, which is in Utah. And it's like currently the biggest, place that you can go skiing. And it was funded by James Laughlin, who started New Directions. It's just like a famous publishing house. It's still around. And he really funded this like avant-garde publishing practice through like the ski resort. And so it was like kind of embedded together that he had this like adjacent, you know, passion in skiing, but then also was like really interested in kind of bringing together this like contemporary form of prose that was different at the time. And then he met all these friends who were kind of going through similar transitions. like he would bring in like Nabokov, Vladimir Nabokov, to the ski resort, who also had a side hobby. He was like really into moths. He like that was like his adjacent interest, and he came to this ski resort in search of a very specific moth. And during this time there, he like decided he was going to abandon his previous name and go by Nabokov. And that's like, you know, where, you know, he became more famous for it. And then, you know, the New Directions publishing, it started off as this kind of experimental thing. But then when Alvin Lustig, who also became friends with James Laughlin, they started working together, he turned the books into these like really memorable mid-century kind of graphic things that really kind of worked as packaging. And then, you know, they started taking the books from the backs of bookstores and putting them up front, and they started turning over, and they just were much more commercially successful. And I think he's sort of credited as being this amazing designer for this achievement, but actually I think it's sort of the wrong way of framing it, because it kind of puts the impetus on like a hero for solving this, and rather, you know, his wife was helping him too. And I think it's more about how design can be used to distribute information and makes it more accessible to people, rather than being, you know, a work of art per se that's very honest. But that being said, the ski resort was also kind of going through the same change. And so, like I said, you know, when James Laughlin got it, I don't think there were any like ski lifts or anything like that. And then over time, it became more popular. People kept coming. There were lots of tourists, and it became like less wild. So I guess in short, like my story is about how things get remembered and, you know, what would happen if you were remembered for something that you were actually passionate about quietly, rather than, you know, the thing that becomes more successful. And if one is more honest than the other. Yeah.
Mm. Right. Then we would think of Nabokov as somebody who is famous for moths.
Yeah. Isn't that funny?
It's really funny. It's fascinating. I need to read this full piece now. It definitely like sparked my interest when I saw the description. Blood, I was like, how is she going to pull this off? How is she going to weave all three of these things together? But of course you did. And I was thinking about the first piece that you told me about that you'd worked on when we first were getting to know each other, which is a piece about the digitization of the Serbian Cyrillic alphabet during the Yugoslav wars. It's always stayed with me because I just didn't know anything about this topic. And I remember your post about buying the necklace on your birthday, or like the day before your birthday, because you and I are the like exact same age. Like I was also right. born in 1991, but you were born in Belgrade. It was all the way across the world. So I'm curious, like, just how this story came together, because it continues to feel very relevant to cultures in conflict and potentially losing pieces of their history to the internet, but also having the opportunity to preserve on the internet at the same time. And also like your own personal history and like your relationship with the language.
Sure. Yeah, it's a really interesting question, and thanks for remembering that and reading it. So you're right. Yeah. I was born in 1991, and I was born in Belgrade. And at that time it was still Yugoslavia. And that particular year was interesting because I think two big things were happening, you know, like, the country was starting in a war, so it was falling apart. The Soviet Union collapsed recently, and also the internet was starting to take form and become more widespread. And, I think growing up, I always spoke Serbian at home, and I grew up in California, by the way. So my family moved away from Yugoslavia in like 1992. And so I really grew up in California. And so I was always hearing about Yugoslavia, and I had this culture of Serbian at home. And I was always translating one language from the next. And so we kind of preserved the culture within our household, but I was very much like American and you know, grew up in the suburbs in California, and then St. Louis in California again. And I wrote this piece when I was in grad school, actually, and I was looking at how type has data embedded into it. And I was really interested in looking at old type files that you can't access anymore. And I was curious if you could load them up or what they looked like. And that was mildly interesting. Like, actually, it's just not, it's just like these old like file formats that aren't super useful. But it made me think about type in general and letter forms that I'm familiar with, and where, if there's like a presence about them online at all. And so Serbia is pretty interesting because it has always been biscriptal. So they use both like the Latin text and then also the Serbian Cyrillic alphabet, which is not the Russian Cyrillic alphabet. It's like slightly different. And so I was curious, you know, what, like, were people still using the Cyrillic alphabet? Why you don't see it online anymore? And a lot of it has to do with just like the, what I was saying earlier, like the time that this country was falling apart, you know, the West was really pushing forward the internet. And so a lot of standards about online communication are built in English primarily, or optimized for the English language. And so to use alphabets in Serbia, it was a lot of hacking. I interviewed this woman, Olivera Svedinovic, and she was responsible for creating U-Times, which was like this edit of Times New Roman to have like some of the Serbian characters that you could use. And then when I interviewed her, she told me she was really embarrassed about this, actually, because it was like adopting a Serbian hat almost on, or a style onto like somebody else's Western typeface. And so it really inspired her to create all of her own typefaces that were like homegrown specifically for the Serbian alphabet that had both a Cyrillic and the Latin text. And also like during that time in the early, or in the 90s and so forth, you had to use special character encoding to get these letters to appear. And so it was really a big hack because like people were distributing like U-Times on like USB drives or whatever. And then if you didn't have it, you would have like brackets in place of the correct letters. So the language just really wasn't supported on the internet. Mm. And yeah, I mean, like, you know, I would go back to Serbia when I was growing up. And I think even when I was like a teenager, we had, you know, internet all the time at home. I think at the point it was like using MySpace, but then you'd go there and you still had to like put the phone, you know, connect the phone to the computer to get it to work at my grandma's house, or you'd go to internet cafes. So yeah, I think to answer your question, it's more, it was very much personal. And then sort of thinking about how my own history mirrors this, this difference is falling apart of a country. And then also like kind of the layers of bias that prevent, you know, a national script being on the same level and continues to be sort of isolated because of those changes.
I think you and I both share a really big interest in this sort of tiny web. And you had one project that you had created like almost 10 years ago that you brought back recently called wildflowers.garden. And you described it as, there are many similarities between gardens and websites. They both evolve over time and you can design them how you would like. Sometimes something unexpected happens and the garden returns a different result than what you expected. Perhaps they both can encourage you to slow down and appreciate the change of the seasons. I spent some time on the website yesterday, but I was wondering if you could explain what it is and what the inputs are and how you created it, because I know some of it started off as drawings from your sketchbook.
Yeah, thanks for looking at that. It is interesting how you can make something and put it online and then it sort of takes on a different life and you don't know always how it's going to react or how other people are going to interact with it and how it starts to change meaning. But yeah, it's a project I made like winter break or something in like 2015, 2016. And I was just interested in experimenting with the web browser as a medium. And, you know, I was working at Kate Spade at the time as an in-house graphic designer. I was working in ad agencies. So I was doing a lot of work for other people and not so much for myself. And I have always liked to draw. And at the time I was thinking about if there's a way of bringing in that warmth that happens when you're just like sketching and you have this like inherent brushstroke, if you will. And if it's possible to put that online and maintain a little bit of it. Because I think oftentimes, especially at that time, it's like things are very geometric and flat online. Mm. So I scanned my illustrations and I love scanners, by the way. We use them for this Invisible Nightlife for the drawings on that too. But anyway, and I've had my scanner since like 2012, 2011. So it's you know, strong piece of hardware. But anyway, so I scanned them and then I digitized them in Illustrator and I put all of the different flowers on different layers. And then my business partner helped me code it at the time and we put it online. And I've always been interested in like very small interactions. And so parallax scrolling is like mm-hmm. in video games when someone looks like they're walking, but it's like actually just the background moving or something. Mm. It's like that type of effect. And so that's exactly what's happening on this when you move your cursor, all the different layers shift. And they're all paired with little quotes about gardening that could be interpreted as advice for life. And you know, I put it up and I forgot about it, to be honest. I just, you know, did it. But then over time, I kept seeing it circulated. Like it's been shared a bunch on Arena. Once someone from Australia reached out to me and they're like, I'm visiting New York and I love this project. Can I meet you? And that was very special. Wow. We got matcha. Mm-hmm. And yeah. And like then just, you know, I guess it's been 10 years since then. I got an email from this publishing house in Austria. And they said they were working on this book for Zora Klipp, who is a German cook. And she wanted to use these illustrations on this like book that's producing. Cool. And so cool. And like, all this happened during Venus retrograde, which I tend to care about. Mm. So it really was like this creative project from the past coming back. And, you know, I was really surprised by it. And so then I ended up re-releasing it as like a limited edition collection on a USB on Meta Label. But yeah, very unexpected how things can kind of gain traction without your control, really. It's
interesting because like at the beginning of this, when you said how like a website is like a garden, I was thinking about how like at first it didn't make sense to me because a website, maybe you put it up and like things start to degrade. Maybe it was built in the era of Flash and then, you know, Flash mm-hmm. disappears and things start to degrade. But then I'm thinking of the building next to me. They've been doing a gut renovation since like October. Who knows when they'll be done? But they totally razed the garden. Like they just destroyed it. They dug everything up. It was so beautiful. There was like a grid of cement. There was a magnolia tree that was like 20 feet tall that they cut down for no reason. And they like, you know, dug into all the garden and stuff. And then it was just a patch of dirt. And this summer it just came back. Right. And it's like, it's so lush now. And there's all these bits of seeds that had been like buried down below, and there's sunflowers, ferns, just so much stuff, right? Like it's so persistent that they couldn't really destroy it. And to me, that was like the opposite of a website. But I guess the way then at the end, like the way I see that a website is like a garden is more like, it's not that like the website itself like propagates and changes in this like lush replicative way, but more like the way like the people interacting with it are in this garden that was, you know, they tried to destroy and it's just come back. It's more like the interactions people have with it are kind of the blooms in it, maybe.
Yeah, that is really beautiful. And it's an interesting way of thinking about it. And that garden seems very persevering in your example. But, you know, I think about when people die and what happens to their web pages. Unfortunately, I had a mentor pass away and he sort of kept his website up as sort of like a final piece of authorship, I'd say. And, you know, he was super careful. He removed his social media presence on Instagram, like LinkedIn, but he kept this one web page. And then it just, you know, I guess after the domain expired or whatever, it went down. And then there's like a Russian casino now in its place. Oh, wow. And it's so sad. But if you go to Wayback Machine, you can still see these traces of him. And if it was registered under his name. So I imagine if somebody else has that name and they buy that domain, you know, they'd see that history. But
This reminds me too. I'm not on Facebook. I think I like haven't really logged onto Facebook regularly since like 2018 or something. But I remember mm-hmm. in college, I was so fascinated with how people would like memorialize other people on Facebook and like mm-hmm. the way that they would continue posting on their walls every birthday, or like there would be these pages created, these like, I don't, you know, I guess you just call it a page. I forget the Facebook nomenclature for this person and how people would like leave memories there. And like, I don't know. I'm sure that's still a thing there. And I guess I see too, like on Instagram.
My mom, like somewhat unceremoniously gave me my like grandmother, my family friend Cheryl, we call her my grandmother, whose main house I live in part time. Like mm-hmm. she very unceremoniously, like before shutting down her phone plan, was like, and also by the way, like if you're somebody who has to handle somebody's estate, there are so many different things that you don't think about. But she was like, okay, here's her phone. Like you need to go into her Facebook and you need to basically like, I don't know if she told me like you have to do it this way, but basically mm-hmm. like I can't remember if I posted as her or wrote a status on her wall basically saying like she's passed away, this is when the memorial is, but then I was yeah. the one who like requested to take it over and turn it into a memorial page.
Which is a thing you can do formally. They have a formal thing for that now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's mm-hmm. a process for it. But actually, oh my God, I think I blocked this out because it was really, you know, it was emotional. So you can do it, but you have to have their death notice. Wow. So I either wrote on her wall or wrote something as her, if I'm remembering correctly. And then my mom gave me her death notice. You have to take a picture of it and upload it to prove that you are close enough to this person to take over the page. And so that must be how we did it. But I didn't. Yeah, it took me a second to remember that because I like completely blocked it out because it was emotional. And then getting messages from people who knew her that like didn't know was emotional. And yeah, there's been a lot of really great writing about the internet and grief mm-hmm. and how things are preserved, but also how they can degrade and that can become part of the grieving process. But I feel like there's always so much more to say. Like I never really get over it. And there's always new things that are like,
always new platforms.
Oh, that's that people horrible. Are grieving
like in different ways.
My friend found out her friend died from a Partyful update.
Oh my God.
That's awful.
Yeah. I think she's written about it a little bit. So it's Terry, and Terry was supposed to go to her friend's birthday party. And then for whatever reason, like the friend who needed to announce it to everyone did it by like writing in the Partyful update, like the party's canceled because this person
Jesus.
Passed away. And it's like,
oh,
I don't know that that's a thing that should ever happen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like when my friend Anthony died, my friend Becca, like I remember this because it was like such a really like kind and decent thing to do, texted me and was like, have you been online today, basically? And I'm like, no, calls me and tells me over the phone. And there were people who knew Anthony that I also knew, who I assumed already knew, that ended up finding out from my posts, which I didn't do until I thought enough time had passed that like everyone must know. And mm-hmm. so it's weird to be on any side of that. And then our old boss didn't find out until I wrote about it in Dirt after the funeral. And so he was like, wait, what? And so then I end up mailing him one of the programs from the funeral because I had taken extra. But you can see like, it feels like there's a hierarchy here, right? Like being able to tell somebody over the phone, being able to give somebody a physical program from the funeral feels very different mm-hmm. and more, I feel like, decent and like real than finding out from like an Instagram story or finding out from a tweet. But it doesn't really feel like we have a ton of control over that anymore unless we decide to be like super intentional about it.
Yeah, that is true. There is sort of a hierarchy of weight in terms of how you would find out and where the appropriate places to announce these things. And it's interesting too, like these big tech platforms, like they want you to keep those profiles up endlessly, like unless, you know, you delete it on your own or somebody takes it over. And, you know, I didn't know that you had to confirm with a death receipt. Like that's also a weird way of bringing in something from the real world that's very like legal, but also emotional into this space. But that requires a lot of effort, you know? And so if you don't do it, it's just like these profiles stay online and they're collecting information without really any type of interception.
Yeah, well, actually, I've been percolating on a new Braided essay, which is like, oh boy, she's at it again. So during COVID, after I got laid off from the New York Review of Books, I was freelancing and applying for stuff, but I had like way too much time on my hands. As did we all. And I think like, I feel like most of us like don't really want to admit like what we were doing with that time or even remember. But I remember because I became obsessed, and I mean obsessed, with this unsolved mystery about this woman, Jennifer Fergate, who was found in, she was found dead, presumed suicide, in a locked on the inside Oslo hotel room. And this was before this case was on Netflix's Unsolved Mystery. So there wasn't as much attention on it. It was just like a lot of Reddit threads. Mm-hmm. And what fascinated me about this is like, it's one of the rare cases where like, oftentimes like somebody is missing and you have their identity, but you don't know where they are. Or in this case, like there was a body and there was like what she put to check into the hotel, but what isn't known is her real identity. So you had everything about her except her identity, down to, I think they have been able to they've been able to test her DNA to know where she's from, but for legal reasons can't go like a relative database. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I get obsessed with it, and I have Google Doc upon Google Doc of dossiers of every angle of this. And I have spent so much time staring at photos of her body and her belongings. And I'm not usually a true crime person, but there was something about this that seemed like almost literary.
You're on your true and,
yeah, exactly. Where am I going with this? I don't know.
Is it maybe about how her traces online, like kind of you start to form an opinion about this person, even though you don't know them, but there's enough information on?
Yeah, I think it's something that you said about like the document, the legal documents, and like how much work it is. Because when you said that, I was thinking about people who die like kind of isolated, or after all their friends and family are dead, and like nobody's going to do that work. And there's sort of like a category of person, like in New York, a big city, or any big area, that are sort of like just like unclaimed people, unclaimed estates. But a lot of times, like, the identity is known. And so this is kind of a reverse of the traditional unknown mystery. And I became obsessed with it. And so, I don't know, I've been thinking about it a lot in relation to, like, recognition. Like, what does it mean to be recognized or recognize somebody? Why did nobody recognize this woman? And, like, how much information could you have about someone and still, like, misunderstand them?
Yeah. I think that's really fascinating. And it reminds me also, sort of tangential, but you know, Luigi Mangione, like his Goodreads became this like big topic of information for people, and people sort of like drawing all these conclusions. Like I think he read something about the bullet method, you know, for journaling, and people were saying, oh, he took it literally. Like, I don't know, which is inappropriate. but people kept like... So. I think, and then, you know, he says all these people like reaching out to him, he became this like cult hero, but I think people were hungry to like find a piece of his like inner world, and people can kind of project what they want based on the data that's floating around.
Well, what I so often do on this podcast, or like on my other podcast, researching people. I've literally found people's Goodreads to try to triangulate some sort of question I can ask them. Like,
guys, for the record, Nika's having a fridge cigarette during this podcast, which is like the internet has been calling Coca-Cola for some reason.
No, but I think, well, I mean, it's like, I think about like the like, right? Like liking anything on social media, which is like, I mean, now that likes aren't visible on Twitter, it's not really giving other people information about you. But like the purpose of a like isn't to signal, it's just to signify to the algorithm that like, feed me more things like this, or more like insidiously, it's like, as these things become perhaps more tracked by government agencies, it's just your signal, you're just giving out information about yourself for people to like build these profiles, which starts to sound a little tin hat, right? But I mean, that is what it is.
No, it's so true. I asked ChatGPT, like, if you say something about yourself on Twitter that's sarcastic, like ChatGPT will incorporate it as fact. And I was like, I don't know, maybe this is egotistical, but I was like, what does Chat GPT know about me or say about me? Because like sometimes you Google yourself to be like, what comes up? And I'm like, if somebody just went to ChatGPT and was like, who is Daisy Alioto? Like, what would come up? And for some reason, I was like, asked what my height was. I've forgotten that I had done this old tweet that was like, I'm too tall to be a manic pixie dream girl and too short to model, but I'm the perfect height to ruin your life. And ChatGPT is like, Daisy Alioto's like height is unknown, but she has said, and it just like pulls up this tweet, which honestly shouldn't even be online anymore because I use Tweetly. And I was like, okay. And then I was like, can you send me a link to that tweet? And I retweeted it. But I was like, wow, you gotta really be careful. Like, I am in the process of training ChatGPT to believe that I'm related to the Pope, because yesterday I found out that the Pope has an Alioto in his paternal grandparents' line from Sicily. And I'm like, you know, obviously I asked ChatGPT, like, are all Aliotos from Sicily related? And they were like, no, but like, yes. You know what I mean? Like, in the sense that, like, yeah, there probably is like a common ancestor, but to your point about deleting yourself, I took all of my info off 23andMe after the bankruptcy and was like, delete everything. And now I'll never know if I'm actually related to the Pope. Doesn't that suck?
Well, you know, it's about having faith that you are.
Oh my God. Thanks, Francis. Well, actually, this is a really good connection to something else that I wanted to talk about, which is the piece that you wrote for Dirt's Trash Package about the evolution of the desktop trash icon over time. And you had this really good quote where you said, the act of deleting things on computers is misleading. Interfaces tempt us to throw things away, but really we're just moving data around, placing things in a holding folder until more permanent steps are taken. I did take those permanent steps with 23andMe, but I think like this really, you know, it really plays into like what we're saying, which is like, it's almost, data is almost like energy in the universe, and that it's like, there's a fixed amount and it's never really created or destroyed. It's just redistributed, either into a different interface or somewhere we can't go. and I don't know, have you thought about it more since you wrote that article? And like, it seems like the idea of throwing things away online is changing at a really rapid pace.
Yeah, it is. But I think it's, you know, the same argument overall. And certainly not a new idea either. I think also in that article, I quoted Programmed Visions, which is by Wendy Hyuk-Kyung Chun. And in it, she's like talks about the metaphors of computers and being metaphors of metaphors, essentially. And so I don't necessarily think it's a new idea or one that's really changing a whole lot. Well, I don't know. I'm interested in your 23andMe, you know, steps. And if you're confident that they're really...
I'm not confident in that at all, but I can't log back in and be like, chat, are we related to the Pope?
I feel like the metaphor here is more like on the internet, data is litter, right? And it breaks down into these microplastics that get redistributed across, like, you know, whatever data warehouse here and there, and this one scraping that one and like replicated and duplicated. And it's like in the way we were talking about earlier about how, like, you know, a garden will come back and be resurgent and all these little bits of seeds, which seeds are data, right? Will sprout again. It's like anything you put on the internet is sort of like a seed that gets distributed on the wind by these other things that are tracking it and storing it in other places, right?
I used to feel that way.
It's all litter.
But it's like the difference, it's like those pieces of data used to feel more like those dandelion pieces that I can't remember the name for anything today, because they blow on the wind and then they take root. But microplastics feel different. It's like they never take root. They just take up space and sort of invade. And I feel like that's the difference between data that like has information encoded in it and data that's like slop. And like the mechanisms have stayed the same or like accelerated, but it doesn't feel like a fertile garden anymore.
Yeah. Well, also just on microplastics in general, like I saw something, I don't know if it's true, but apparently glass bottles have more of them.
I saw this.
Yeah, I saw that too. Maybe perhaps you even saw that on clone.fyi.
But I mean, it's sort of, maybe it's like a shifting way we're thinking about these microplastics You know, as you were talking, it reminded me of there's this artist, Aaliyah Lialina, and there's the project 1 terabyte of kilobyte age, which is basically all of do you know GeoCities?
Yeah.
So GeoCities, when they shut down, they were just going to get rid of all that data, which, again, I don't really know what that means. But then Aaliyah Lialina and Dragan Espenshid like took over the data, and now it like exists on like a Tumblr, and you can take screenshots of the little sites. So I don't know what my point is exactly, but it felt like there was a real fear of this data being gone forever, because it's such a snapshot of people's way of expressing themselves on the early internet. And then now it kind of lives on. And I know Rhizome, I think, owns it as well, maybe.
I wanted to go back to asking you about working for Kate Spade, because every time I remember introducing you to my friend Alex at the Blank launch party, and I was like, I felt like I was introducing the two most interesting women in the world, because both of you, each time I talk to you, you drop like some lore that I'm like, how is that possible that you've lived like 7 different lives? Like every time I talk to Alex, she'll be like, oh, when I worked at this architecture firm, I'm like, what? Or like, oh, I dated, you know, redacted band member. And it's like, what? You know, like, and I feel similarly with you, Nika. Like, I had no idea that you had been at Kate Spade until I looked at your LinkedIn in preparation for this call. And I feel like I have this weird thing where I'm convinced that, like, Obama era Kate Spade explains everything about, like, the shift in visual culture, maybe related to Edmund Lau's, like, dark mode theory. But that was, like, peak light mode, right? Like, everything was wonderful. Everything was great, which made, we're talking about death a lot today, which made like Kate Spade's suicide, I think, that much darker to people, because it felt so incongruous with the public aesthetic and persona of the brand. But they also did have like such a strong, interesting visual language. And this was before the sort of like, I'm just a girl thing. Like, it was just very whimsical. And I'm curious, like, what that experience was like. Did you identify with that visual language? Did you help develop it? Do you still have Kate Spade purses from the Obama era? I think I finally moved mine along.
yeah, that's a really interesting question. And your friend was really lovely, so thanks for introducing us. But and just from what you were talking, the first thing that immediately came up was thinking about the impact of her suicide. And I remember finding out that she had hung herself like in her house with like a red scarf. And I get goosebumps thinking about that, that it felt very in line with her whole sensibility and like what the store, you know, represented. And, you know, it's interesting how something can feel so lighthearted and whimsical and fun, but then has this like weighty, sinister quality to it. Similar to like the Virgin Suicides aesthetic too. Like, I think the way that book was written is lyrical, and the way that Sofia Coppola represented it visually, this like naivety to it that was super stylized, but then there's like this weight to it.
I was at a knockoff Pinkberry when I found out. So like, I mean, throw Froyo in the mix. Want to talk about like the Obama era. Like, I was literally getting Froyo with my mom at a knockoff Pinkberry. I forget what it's called. I think it has like a frog on it. And it's like
mango. Was it red mango or something like that?
I don't know. They're like Christian. Okay. I'll look it up. It was like a Christian knockoff Pinkberry with a cartoon frog. And I'm like sitting there with my mom. I'm like, oh, Kate Spade killed herself. Just like, talk about like one little event that's not even the biggest event, but feels like the end of an era.
I remember where I was too. I remember I was in the Flatiron, that park, like, is it Madison Square Park? Like, yeah. I was there and it was warm out. And I remember having to sit down. Like, I was really surprised.
Yeah,
you're right. It's not like 9/11 by any means, but it was still something that you had like an emotional reaction to if you, you know, maybe resonated with that visual language in that time period.
Yeah, absolutely. We were talking about book covers earlier, and I wanted to jump in with this, but I thought it made more sense in the context of what we're launching next week. We had this great piece in Prune by Becca Walks about the evolution of Italo Calvino covers over time. And I think at that point, we were already hard at work on what we'll be launching next week with some of Nika's students, which is a new edition of the Nightlife Review. But this edition is, I have to say it's our most beautiful edition because it has been, there is a custom website and web home for it that Nika designed. And it is a Italo Calvino themed. So we took the idea and vibe and structure of the book Invisible Cities, which is one of my favorite books about, you know, it's sort of a retelling of visiting these cities that don't really exist. And all of them are sort of in some form, Venice, which is the narrator's home, and applying it to nightlife. And we gave the students this prompt of like, what would invisible nightlife be? You know, what would it be like to tell tales and stories and create multimedia presentations of a speculative version of nightlife? And the outcome is this Invisible Nightlife edition of the Nightlife Review. And I'll let Nika talk about how she decided to represent that visually, because it's, you know, my favorite part of the whole thing, obviously.
Thanks. Yeah, it's been really fun working on that together. And we share that reference or the book as one of our favorites as well. And in terms of the design, I wanted something to feel that felt ephemeral, but also had a nod to the original book covers. I think that was also a reference we looked at together, where there's kind of this coherent system to all of the Calvino books, whereas like signature or handwriting writes out the cover, and then there's like these abstract shapes. And so I think having something that could be replicable and having a visual language to it that had some sort of hidden meaning was important. And then I also really like this idea of developing like a fictional environment. And I think a lot of the stories ended up echoing that sentiment. And so the website itself shuts down. So it's only online technically from 12 to 6 a.m. And,
Francis's mind is blown.
I mean, there may or may not be like a loophole. Yeah, there may not be a loophole. But
she had to tell me though. I never would have discussed.
There's a VIP line.
Yeah, because we do want to make sure the students are able to share their work, because we did make this to help them, you know, and distribute their work and give them an opportunity to publish, experiment with language and form. And so. So that's like a big part of the design. It also kind of straddles this idea of being like nostalgic and contemporary. Like the two typefaces we're using, one is called Visual by all caps, is sort of like a modern day pixel typeface, but it's also very smooth, like actual pixel typefaces that are bitmapped from, you know, the 90s are always jagged because that was a limitation of the screens. Whereas this one is actually like almost just has like a nice texture to it. And then Ivory by Linto is, I don't know, I see it as sort of like a 1970s serif. It's like very weighty. There's not a lot of contrast. So there's like a lot of heaviness to the site. And then there's like these moments that are fleeting, like it's not online all the time. On desktop, the table of contents sort of rotates around slowly, kind of working like a clock. And then I also, again, used illustrations that I drew with a Sharpie and then scanned. So yeah, I think there's a lot of friction and tension between, you know, weight and then time. That's how I would describe the design.
Can't wait to see it.
Yeah, there's a way to read Invisible Cities where you're sort of like following this system of categories and subcategories that Calvino set out, and it's very complicated. Like I've read it multiple times and I wouldn't claim to like 100% understand how that works. Well, it's actually a quick read. It's what makes it not quick is if you really wanted to delve into some of these systems that he set up. But we decided to do a nod to that with like these four sort of like symbols that Nika drew, and they correspond with like four different categories. So there's eight stories and two in each category. So you could do it by, you know, reading one category first. And then we took that from one of the students' pieces where she had these four categories and different diary entries where you can read them all the way through, or you could take four different tracks through the piece where you only read the entries that fall into each category.
Yeah, I thought that was really beautiful. And I love the way Michaela's piece ended up doing that and offering a system for us to use. I think there were never ending white blood and buried nights.
Yeah.
That was really smart. And yeah, I think it's about the design too. In the original Invisible Cities, that system that Daisy's describing is like, I feel like it's what order they're in, and then how many times it appears in a certain category. So it's like there's two numbers.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, we nodded to that, but ours is a little more simple. It's just like, yeah, you know, the categories have an image that goes along with it.
Yeah. It was a good experience for me. I mean, you work with students all the time, but I don't often have the experience of working directly with people that are in an educational environment. And I think that that was really good for me to do. It's a different type of workshopping and learning than I would do with a freelance writer, even though the editorial process is the same. So I was really grateful for that opportunity as well.
Yeah, we were really lucky to have you. And I think it's just such a luxury to get to meet an editor and to have feedback, you know, outside of the school, and also to create the space for humanities to exist outside of academia. I really think it's so important. And I think, you know, there's a lot of concerns about AI and how that's impacting creative fields. But I think having a personal style and way of communicating, whether it's through language, form, websites, whatever, it's always going to be important.
I think that's the perfect note to end on. Do you agree, Francis?
I do agree. This has been Tasteland.
Francis is a little jet lagged.
I'm what? I'm jet lagged. I'm a little jet lagged.